good evening. Evening. Hi. Let's see. So, how many people are brand new? I see some new faces. Oh, half of you. Okay, that's good. It's almost 10 after 8, so... I'll do probably a tiny bit of review, but not much, so you might be a little bit lost. So let me do some housekeeping. Phone's on mute, if that's possible, or vibrate, if you need to be in touch with the outside world, because someone may need to reach you. For people who are brand new, the restrooms are out that door and around to the left. Let's see... This, as Scott has introduced himself to people as they come in, questions are wonderful and they're welcome. If you have any questions, Scott has a mic and we ask that you use it because Brian, the techno guru for the night, is streaming the teachings for people that could not attend. And if you don't use a mic, what they hear is what from The Simpsons is, rah, 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 rah. So it doesn't make any sense. So if you'd help the folks that may or may not be, that may be streaming it. Let's see. So the menu for tonight is we were going to start with intention and scanning the body. So one of the things that we're going to do is I'm going to interrupt myself. CJ, would you do me a favor and let Karen, who's outside, know and tell her that she may go home?
I spoke to her on
Wayne. Great. Just let her know that she can go home. Yeah. Because she, yeah, that would be grateful. Because you and I are meeting, right?
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So one of the things that's very important in Buddhism, in, well, I don't know about other traditions, but in this tradition, is that the best way to say it is by intending to do something and then doing it, but setting your intention, whether it be to be kind, go swimming, go on a diet, whatever it is, but we'll just say be kind, you get a bigger bang for your buck. And so we're going to start the evening essentially by saying, may this evening be of benefit to your mind. May it be of benefit to anyone you come in contact with. And if nothing else, may you at least enjoy the next hour and 20 minutes. So, and with that, that's what it feels like. It's been one of those weeks. Last week, you know, we did the 7-point posture, and we also did counting the breaths. And I was looking at the notes and saying, why didn't we do this one first, the scanning? And so I rearranged the syllabus, which is apt for me to do. I don't like it that way. I'll change the order. And so what I'm going to do is walk you through one of the handouts, which was called Scanning the Body. And I won't go through the 7-point posture because there are people that are brand new here. But what I would just like to suggest is that you find a comfortable position. Usually if you're on a cushion or in a chair, especially in these chairs, you'll find that if your back is fairly straight as opposed to this, you really end up being a little more comfortable. And one of my teachers talks about relaxing into a posture by pretending that your skeleton is a hanger. You know, and it's kind of like shaped, the top part's kind of shaped like a hanger. And that just everything else is kind of, it's not kind of, is hanging off of it. And if you think about clothes on a hanger in your closet, you know, they move easily and they wiggle and they're kind of relaxed and they're not like how we carry ourselves all the time. So take a couple of deep breaths and or comfortable breaths and close your eyes or put them at half mast, whatever's most comfortable for you. And I'll walk you through this. So starting at the top of your head, you know, settle in, kind of get grounded on the cushion. And start paying attention to your physical body. And again, seeing if you can relax into this position. Focusing your attention on the top of your head. Start scanning down slowly. And notice where there might be tension. You know, tension in your brow, tension in your temples, in your cheeks. See if you can soften your face a little. Usually when you do that, your lips don't necessarily come apart, but your jaw drops a little bit. And as you continue the scan, noticing the places that are tight, they may or may not loosen up, but you can invite them to, give them permission to say, you're here, you're safe, no phone's going to ring for a little bit, and you can relax and just be present. As you continue scanning down, notice, you know, shoulders for a lot of people, especially, you know, I guess if you're shoveling, your shoulders are tight because you worked really hard, and if you're sitting at your desk, your shoulders are really tight. Either way, your shoulders do a lot of work during the course of the day. And so see if you can let them drop away from your ears, you know, give up your turtle status, and you know, let your arms hang a little more loosely in your lap. Relaxing your elbows. And breathing in, you know, sometimes one of the things people talk about is even feeling somewhat tight in their chest. And so taking a couple of deep breaths or comfortable breaths, kind of expanding your rib cage, expanding into your abdomen, and letting those muscles kind of just settle down. Notice if you're feeling a little more grounded in your chair or on your cushion. You know, if your body feels a little bit heavier in a positive way. You know, continue scanning and seeing, you know, is there tension in your thighs, knees, lower legs. You know, offering some kind thoughts to your sore muscles if they're sore or tight, inviting them to relax and rest. Any discomfort you might have, kind of breathing into it. And all the way down to your toes. If it feels good, give them a little wiggle. And again, check in. Feeling a little more here, a little more grounded, a little more present. And just stay with this for a minute. You know, being with your breath, continuing to give your body just a chance to rest and not have any job to do other than be here. And so with a wish for you to be safe, body to be safe, and to be healthy, take another breath or so when you're ready. Come on back so I can chatter at you. Oh, okay. Excuse me, for the new people, my name's Kondo. Sorry. Let's see. So, speed version of last week is we covered a tiny bit about the mind. We covered the Four Noble Truths, a little bit about the biography of Shakyamuni Buddha, and the seven-point meditation posture, and a beginning concentration meditation called Counting the Breath. If you go on the Kadampa Center website, under Spiritual Programs, you will see Buddhism in a Nutshell, and under there you will find seven handouts, which has all the meditations that we've done, scanning the breath, counting, scanning the body, counting the breath, and one sheet, the foundation of all good qualities, and one sheet on the Four Noble Truths for those who are new. And you might find that useful. So I'm going to... any questions from last week before I get started? Thank you for coming back. Thank you. Okay, so last week I talked about the biography of the Buddha, born 2,500 years ago as a prince, gave that up to work on his mind, and in the process became what Buddha means, a fully awakened one, which means he had eliminated all negative states of mind and had completely cultivated to the absolute extent possible all positive states of mind, which in a sense he had completely had developed infinite wisdom and compassion. Hard to believe, unimaginable. And the most important thing about that the Buddha said was not only had he done it, but that any sentient being, any mind possessor could do it. And in Buddhism, sentient beings are anything we in our Western culture would consider part of the animal realm, beginning with the smallest one-celled amoeba. Hard to think about them as mind possessors, but from the Buddhist perspective, they are. And they all have Buddha nature, which has the capacity for infinite wisdom and compassion. Just presenting it as the point of view. But today we'll talk about the history of Buddhism. Buddha lived until people discuss whether it was 80 or 81 years old. Taught from, some people say 40 years, some people say 45 years. And then passed away. But during the time that he lived, many people decided that they were really interested in what he had to say, and they were so interested in what he had to say that they wanted to follow him around all the time. And the Buddha said, yeah, okay, you can follow me around all the time, but if you want to follow me around all the time, you got to live like I do, which means you got to be celibate. You're not going to own anything and other than your robes and a begging bowl, and you're going to live without a roof over your head, and we're going to wander from place to place, and we're going to work on meditation and practice, and when we're asked to, we're going to offer the Dharma. Well, guess what? Lots of people did it, both men and women. There was a long story about how women got to do it, but by the time the Buddha died, there were both monks and nuns as wandering mendicants or holy people. And once he died, shortly after he died, within a few minutes after he died, they got together and they said, well, you know, how are we going to preserve this? You know, how are we going to keep what we've learned? How are we going to keep what we've learned now that our primary teacher has passed? How are we going to keep it? And how are we going to be able to share it? And so there was what they call the first Buddhist council. Of course, you get more than, even when you get a few monks together, within a really short period of time, people have different opinions about what happened and what went on. But one of the things they did is nothing was written down. And they said, so how are we going to preserve this? I mean, it's not written down. But most learning at that time took place by someone saying it, you repeating it, saying it, repeating it, and through memorization. So Buddhism wasn't, you know, particularly unusual in that. So what they did at the first Buddhist council was they, three of this, I can't, one was Ananda, one was Magagala, and one was, and I don't remember the third one, who were particularly strong disciples of the Buddha and his primary attendants. One recited the collection of teachings about practices and how to live. One recited the Vinaya, which were the rules that came up about how monks and nuns were supposed to behave. And the third one recited the teachings on kind of what one would call Buddhist philosophy. And they're called the three baskets. And so that happened, and then about 100 years later, and so there was, and this is in northeast, what would be northeast India. Well, there were, they continued to have, have meetings, and so what would happen is that's the primary function of the monks, besides teaching, is to help each other memorize and remember the teachings. The first time that they were written, so within a short period of time, probably within about maybe 50 or 100 years, there was never any disagreement about the Four Noble Truths, ever, 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 nor the fact that Buddha existed or, you know, the core beliefs of Buddhism. But some of the finer points that I really don't know because I've only really studied Buddhism from this particular tradition. But there were some leaders, and what happened is one group that saw things a little bit differently. So here's India, and it's in northeast India. There was a, I'm going to assume that, I don't know if that's east or west, but there was a, the Buddhism began to spread. It spread in an arc this way, and it spread in an arc this way. And the Buddhism that was in northeast India and then went into southeast India, was the basis for what we call the Mahayana tradition, which is the tradition that we're in, that Tibetan Buddhism is in, and also into Tibet and China. The spread that went to the West went to Burma, and it's kind of funny, how did it go to the West when Burma, Sri Lanka, and Southeast Asia, you know, are in the opposite direction. So I haven't quite figured out the geography on that one. Became what is called Theravadin or the Hinayana path. The first texts were written down in 83 before the Common Era, which is like 400 years after Buddha died, almost 300 or 400 years after the Buddha died, on the island of Sri Lanka, and that was in the Theravadin, and it was translated from, it actually doesn't say, and I haven't been able to find this, whether it was translated from the it was translated from the Sanskrit into the Pali canon, the Pali, which was the language, and it's now referred to as the Pali canon, which is the text that you will find in Vietnam, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, I think possibly Afghanistan, and also you will find it and the And that's 83. And then it says that before the Common Era, about, you know, within about 50 years of the same time, Prakrit was the language of the Buddha. That was the dialect spoken in the Shakya kingdom. It was translated into Sanskrit. Other people say they never had the Sanskrit. The Sanskrit was no longer extant when they, and it was translated from the Pali canon. I'm not sure. What's very interesting is when scholars are looking at the sutras now and doing translations, there are some differences, but the similarity between what was the Chinese canon, the Pali canon, and the Sanskrit that remains is extremely similar. There are some significant, they say they're significant, but I am not a linguist or a scholar, and the only thing I can say correctly in Tibetan is Tashidelik, which means hello. So I have to take people's word for it. I have to just have confidence in scholars. So if anybody is really curious about this, a very, very reliable source, and I'm going to use the wrong marker, is, I'm going to put it, where shall I put it, is Alex Berzin, and it's B-E-R-Z-I-N. And if you look up Berzin Archives, B-E-R-Z-I-N, and you can put in just about any topic. You can put in the spread of Buddhism, the history of Buddhism, or whatever. And you will get a tremendous amount of detail and probably about as reliable as any source you'll find. And he does this, it's what's amazing, this is what I find amazing about practitioners, he's been a scholar, Tibetan scholar, Buddhist scholar for decades and decades, and he did this just out of the great generosity of his heart to be able to share, you know, information and to share what was reliable. So, and Buddhism did spread. There was a king in, when was Asoka, Ashoka? Sometimes it's Ashoka, sometimes it's Asoka. Maybe first century before the Common Era, maybe a little bit before that. At one time, and he became Buddhist and he decided that everybody else should be Buddhist. Now, he didn't lop off people's heads because they didn't want to be Buddhist, but he was quite encouraging. And at one time, the kingdom that he was in charge of spread from western Afghanistan all the way through pretty much what is now the middle of China, which is a fairly big swath of land, and it was all Buddhist. Pretty much Buddhist. Buddhism came to Tibet fairly late. It came to Tibet in 6th or 7th century with a Tibetan practitioner considered very realized being called Padmasambhava. And he is considered the founder of the Nyingma tradition in Tibetan Buddhism. So, in Tibetan Buddhism, there are four traditions. As I said last week, this center is in the Gelug tradition, which comes out, well, I won't even go into it. Started in the, probably in the late 14th, early 15th century in Tibet. But there other traditions are, so there's Gelug, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Shakya. Kagyu. So, and let's see, Kagyu is the Karmapa, right? Yeah, Kagyu. Kagyu. Let's see. Let me get it straight now. So the Holiness of Dalai Lama is in the Gelug tradition. He is considered leader of the Gelug tradition. Yes, Kagyu is, and then Kagyu Nyingma. Why am I blanking? And Sakya. It's not Shakya. Yeah, okay. So there are some differences in how they view the mind. There's some differences in how they, what they consider most important in terms of practice. But if you and I were sitting here listening to a highly realized Nyingma practitioner and a highly realized Gelug practitioner talking about the Four Noble Truths, we wouldn't have a clue there were differences. I mean, it's at a very sophisticated and high level of practice. And that doesn't mean I discount it. I think it's very important for our teachers in terms of guiding me. But it takes a little while. And I think the reason I think it's important is one of the things that's said about the Buddha is that he had 84,000 different teachings. And that one of his skills as a teacher and his great care for sentient beings and wanting everybody to to have a positive shot at working on their minds and transforming them is that he always had in mind that none of us are the same. He always had in mind that none of us are the same, and that people understanding the Four Noble Truths and being able to implement them in their lives was very dependent on how they took in information and how they used it. And so how he taught and what he taught varied from person to person in terms of what would most benefit their mind. So a way of thinking about the four traditions is not necessarily how they evolved, is that in the Gelug tradition, scholarship and study and philosophy is tremendously emphasized, along with practice and meditation, but it's a tremendous emphasis. They've developed an incredible university system for training. In the Nyingma tradition, there's a tremendous, scholarship is tremendously important, but the focus comes at it through certain meditational practices that are the first step. You know, in the Gelug tradition, the first thing you'll get is study and learn this. In the Nyingma tradition, the first thing you'll get is kind of some coaching and meditation in terms of mindfulness and then leading into the study. So, well, if you think about it, those are two different styles of kind of being engaged in something that one thing, one might suit one person and another might not suit another person at all. And so the Buddha was very, very skillful at doing this. And that's why, and the reason I bring it up is because you'll read one sutra and then you'll read another sutra and you'll go, this sounds like a contradiction. And there are no contradictions in the teachings. They're coming at it always from a different angle to whatever the audience was for that teaching at that time, so it would be the most beneficial to them. So that's the history of the spread of Buddhism. When it spread to the south in India, it became the basis for the Mahayana tradition, and there were established tremendous monasteries in southern India, a place called Nalanda. I mean, and if you think about this, probably 3rd century before the Common Era was the beginning of Nalanda. At one point, there were probably 5,000 monks there. I mean, you think about a community, you know, India was always populated, but not the way it is today. And so in the school of what makes the tradition in which I am studying and which is the point of view you get here. Sorry, guys, I can't give you any other point of view than this one because it's the only one I know. And even if I did, this is an FPMT center and we're a Galoop tradition, so I got to make a commitment that that's the point of view you're going to get if you come here. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with any of the other point of views. They're all wonderful. It's just the only one I know. But the point of the tradition we're in, which was the Galoop tradition, and this is important for the rest of this class, Galoop-pa. All pa means is practitioner. So it's one who is one of these. And the founder of that was a person named Lama Tsongkhapa. And he's the author of the 15 stanzas that is in the handout called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. And the point of all that is that what he did and what the Galoop tradition claims is it made a concerted effort to say, to bring together wisdom and compassion in terms of, and so when Buddhism went south, that's probably not quite the way we want to say it because it's not necessarily, but when Buddhism went south to Nalanda, There was a person by the name of Nagarjuna, you don't need to remember any of this, who was very, very focused on wisdom. And also in that southern, and this is from a Sangha, okay, was a guy named Shantideva, who was focused on compassion. That was his. He also had a lot of wisdom, but he was focused on compassion. And so, like us, we kind of tend to have binary minds. How bored is everybody? So, this guy kind of really brought it together and said, you got to have both. And so that's what, in a sense, the rest of the story that I'm going to be trying to tell is going to be about is, and if you want to end suffering, you got to be kind to yourself, but you got to have some skill in how you do it. That's basically what it comes down to. I said before I was a social worker, and there used to be a great phrase among social workers about, this was the Brits who were always, cut to the chase, in a very kind way, and said, don't let your bleeding heart run away with your bloody head. You know, and so it's basically saying being kind is just wonderful. So that's really what we're going to talk about when we talk about this, and then we talk about this. So that brings me to what Buddhism is about the mind. Bless our bodies, in the sense of they are the conditions that enable this mind to manifest and work on itself at this point, since I won't speak for anybody else, but I haven't reached enlightenment. And so what the Buddha discovered when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, saying, I'm not getting up until I figure it out, was this is what he found out about the mind. Now, he said he found it out through his own experience. You have to test it out for yourself. But this is what he said. And he didn't say it first, but this is, I think it's easier to understand the fact that it's easier to understand. You can understand suffering without looking at this, but you sure can't even get to the solution. So I decided I would put it in the middle. So what the Buddha said is that the mind is completely non-material. It is, now, what that would be in Western terms is that it is not the brain. Now, for us to use our minds in this physical form, does it help to have a brain? Yes. But the mind is not the brain. The other thing he said is that the mind is beginningless and it doesn't have a creator. No one made your mind. And what that means is no one can make it up for you. You're completely responsible for your own mind. And again, I'm only presenting these as hypotheses. What the Buddha said was, don't take anything I say on faith. You need to take it, you need to examine it, you need to check it out, see if it fits, see if it doesn't fit. If you can prove to me I'm wrong, then I need to change my mind. Matter of fact, the Dalai Lama still says that today. So there is no creator. Now that is one of the challenges for people in Buddhism. It is a non-theistic tradition. There is no creator God. Now, is an enlightened being omniscient, clairvoyant, omnipotent, all of those things? Yes, because what Buddha said, that is the capacity of our mind, of all beings' minds, when all the junk is cleared out. What he said was that the mind is clear and luminous, that the nature of mind is absolute clarity. And the third thing he says is that its function is to cognize. Why is this important? Lots of people say to me, I can't meditate, or they will say I can't meditate, because they say, I've been told I have to think about nothing. Well, in this arena and in this school, if the function of them, if you agree you have a mind, if you accept the hypothesis that everyone sitting in here has a mind, and if you accept the hypothesis that its function is to cognize or to know, then it can't not think about something. You know, a cup can't function as anything else but a cup. I mean, if that's its function. So I guess it could be a planter. But it's still going to hold something. But I mean, its function is to hold something, you know. So, any questions? I hope not. No. Any questions? Okay. So, what, and mind, another word for mind is consciousness. The mind isn't conscious, the mind is consciousness. That's why, in a sense, it could be non-material. I mean, you know, so let's see. So let's, before I move over here, I'm going to just briefly, for those people who are brand new, do I need to go over the 7-point posture for people who are brand new? Has anybody been and have any basic meditation okay. I'll just zip through it. Okay. There's a 7-point posture that's recommended for meditation, and the reason it's recommended is because it's a physical position that long before Buddhism, thousands of years, probably at least a couple of thousand years before Buddhism, the wandering spiritual seekers of India that were working on their mind discovered it was a very practical position for physical support for when they worked on their minds and were trying to concentrate. And I'm sure everybody in here, if you're sitting in here, you've probably heard about chakras and the energy channels that move through the body. And so what this position does in some ways is, in many ways, in a lot of ways I don't understand, because I think there's 72,000 channels that run through your body, is it helps them be somewhat clear, you know, for energy to flow pretty smoothly. So the first part of the position, number one, is that sit straight, that the main channels run slightly in front of your spinal cord. So sitting like this doesn't help it much. So sitting reasonably straight, and if you're sitting in a chair, your feet flat on the ground or flat on something, a cushion like mine is. If you're sitting this way, your legs crossed, a full Vajra position is, you know, both feet on top of your thighs. Many of us can't do this. So there's half Vajra, or there's your legs just crossed in front of you. But all of you know that, as we refer to it in kindergarten, crisscross applesauce, which is how we now refer to asking kids to cross their legs in school, is a fairly stable position. And then your arms are, you know, here, they're in your lap comfortably. They can be you'll see many in right over left. Again, it has to do with the energy channels. Your arms are slightly akimbo, kind of some space underneath your arms for some airflow. That's, if you're going to sit for a long time, that's just more comfortable. Your head slightly tilted. Your eyes can be closed. They can be at what I call half-mast. The point is to cut out unnecessary external stimuli, but some sense of them being unfocused, not focused. Your gaze is down the ski slope of your nose, and your mouth is relaxed. Tongue is at the on the roof of your mouth, at the back of your teeth. Teeth are slightly apart. And the reason for that is long-term meditators is you don't drool. I mean, it is also circular in terms of the energy channels. So that's the 7-point posture. Again, it's in one of your handouts, so that's all you need. But let's just take a couple of minutes to get comfortable in a way that suits you. And we're going to do a short meditation on clarity of mind, clarity of consciousness. And the intention for this meditation is just kindness to yourself, kindness to your mind. I mention that as important because all kindness, all true compassion springs, has its source in kindness for ourselves. And that in any kindness you experience, in terms of kindness to yourself, will affect other beings you come in contact with in a positive way. So, today was a great day. So, imagine that maybe you could have been on a hill somewhere, you are on a hill somewhere, with a totally unobstructed view. And the sun is warm, not too hot. There's a slight breeze, so you don't get uncomfortable, but not too much, so you're cold. And you look up at the sky. And it's, I guess, what we would call, maybe this is the nature of enlightenment, it's Carolina blue. I don't mean the team. But it has great spaciousness. I mean, when you look at the sky and it's completely clear, you know, how deep is it? You know, you just, there's no question of depth. It just goes on. If any distractions come up, you know, treat them like, you know, that they're just obstructions. They're the mountains in the distance. They're this town in the valley. There's this tree to your right. There's this job you might have to go back to after you've had your time on the hill. But they're not in the way right now. Can just gaze into the sky and it's completely free. So you've let go of that and you're enjoying the beautiful, beautiful, clear sky and thinking to yourself, gee, could my mind be this clear? And then you notice some thoughts are coming up, some feelings are coming up. And allow yourself to think of these as clouds that are just moving through the sky. And they go by and the sky is clear again. It's the same for your mind. Your thoughts are like the clouds. You really can't grab hold of them. We believe we can, but we really can't, because as soon as we've grabbed hold, they change. So allow the thoughts to go by. Allow the clouds to move on. Everything arises like this. Our thoughts, our feelings, our sensations. Our experiences. Sound, smell, taste, touch. But they all arise in this place of clarity and luminosity. So let them arise and let them pass. So enjoy this wonderful, clear, and beautiful sky. Enjoy this wonderful, clear, and spacious mind. Please offer yourself the gift of remembering this spaciousness. In your day, when you're attempting to make important decisions, wanting to benefit others, wanting to know what is most beneficial to do for yourself and others, remember this spaciousness. It will benefit you, and it will benefit all those with whom you come into contact with and who you are serving. And rejoice that you have taken a couple of minutes to watch your mind and become more familiar with its clarity and spaciousness. And when you're ready, come on back. Seem like a reasonable way to spend a couple minutes? Okay, so what does this have to do with this? Okay, well, since I wasn't in Buddha's mind at the time, he did teach the Four Noble Truths first. There is suffering, for review for those people who aren't, there is suffering, there's a cause for suffering, there can be a complete end to all suffering, and there's a way for it to happen. So, given that, you know, so what is so, what I'm going to, so, since I wasn't in Buddha's mind, and he did teach the Four Noble Truths first, I'm not sure what, but I don't want to hear about something, you know, kind of, I don't know, anybody ever have a boss? Don't bring in a problem if you don't already have a solution. I don't know if anybody's ever had bosses like that. You know, I have. But I personally don't like knowing about things that I can't do anything about. There are, now there's lots of things I can't do anything about, but but so he talked, he said there were three kinds of suffering. One was just the suffering of suffering. And, you know, all of us, you know, sickness, old age, death, falling down and breaking a bone, another phrase for it is the suffering of pain. You know, because we're in samsara, because we're in this cyclic existence, and we have these physical bodies and all of that, there's this. Then he talked about the suffering of change. The simplest way I can talk about that is the most classic example is one of the teachers that teaches here, Venerable Rubina, talks about chocolate cake. The first bite of chocolate cake is wonderful. The second bite of chocolate cake is really good. But if you eat the whole chocolate cake, it becomes suffering. Now, you're not doing anything different. You're still eating. But anything we do, if you have to do it forever or it happens to you forever, is probably going to end up feeling like suffering. It may have started out feeling okay. Even Dante thought this. I mean, in the second circle of hell, he has Paolo and Francesca, who were there because of sexual misconduct. And that's where the Catholics put them. But what are they doing in hell? They are forever in this relationship and in the experience that was the misconduct, and they're committed to it forever and ever and ever. Well, Dante saw that as hell. So it is interesting. I don't think Dante ever studied Buddha. But does that make sense? I mean, and Scott, I'd love you if you have any other examples. Do you have any questions about that? Does that make sense to people? Yeah, great.
It's suffering without change then. So if you don't have change, it's suffering.
But is the suffering of...
I have an example that...
Yes, thank you. That's good. Thank you.
Venerable George Chiroff would say, he gave this example, which I thought was really good. Imagine if you're on the beach in the summer, right? It's very, very hot. So you have a high level of suffering of heat.
Uh-huh.
So then you go and get in the water. So as soon as you get in the water to cool off, the suffering of heat starts to decrease. But at the same time, the suffering of cold is starting to increase. And it increases and increases and increases. And they eventually pass each other. So you're in the water. You've been in the water a long time. And the suffering of heat has decreased. But the suffering of cold has increased and increased and increased. And now you're cold.
Mm-hmm.
So you get out of the water and you get back on the beach. And now you're laying on your towel on the beach. And the suffering of cold has been decreasing. But now the suffering of heat is increasing. And so basically anything that we experience is kind of like that. That as we experience one thing and, you know, like you get a new car. So you have this high level of enjoyment of the car, and the suffering of not having a car is way down here. But then, you know, after a while, the car starts breaking down, and you're paying for the insurance, and you're paying the bills. So a lot of the things that we experience as pleasurable end up actually, after we experience them for a while, like they'll have to get the who's in Dante's Inferno? The two?
What?
The two lovers in Dante's Inferno?
Paolo and Francesco.
Paolo and Francesco. So this wonderful thing that they were experiencing, but if you have to experience it again and again and again and over and over and over and forever, just like the first piece of cake is delicious, but the 20th piece of chocolate cake is not so nice. And that's the suffering of change.
Does that make sense? It's not that things don't change, it's that it's so... And I think the other thing is, and I just hadn't thought of saying this before, but I'm going to say it now, is that cake can be suffering in all three of these ways. In the sense, when I hit the 20th piece, I've got the suffering of pain. Okay? So there's that. When I'm eating it, there's the suffering of change. Venerable George has this great thing. Somebody gave him a cookie that he really liked. This is, he's teaching, and he has this, and he goes, oh, biscotti, biscotti, and he eats, you know, takes the first bite. Oh, so wonderful. And then he goes, second bite, and he says, second bite, not quite as good. You know? So there's, and we're still talking about cake. Then we get to pervasive suffering. Which is, when I get a grip on this one, I'll be a lot better. But what pervasive suffering says is that any kind of any experience that we have, quotes, in samsara, cyclic existence, you know, any experience in a sense prior to kind of enlightenment, and this is not to be negative about it, is pervaded with suffering in the sense of the only thing it can do is provide some kind of temporary satisfaction or happiness. My mundane, and I've got to rush, my mundane example of this is when you have a, let's say, a piece of cake, you know, or I'll just use juice cake. Tomorrow, I might not even remember what that piece of cake tasted like. You know, whatever pleasure I had, it's gone. It's, now I might have the memory that chocolate cake is good, and when I'm tired of eating carrot sticks, I may, instead of fantasizing about carrot sticks, I may be thinking about chocolate cake, but basically that pleasure is gone. It's gone. Okay. I can still remember, and essentially, when I worked in the school system with, as a social worker, there was a couple of times that I had an opportunity to provide a couple of kids on different occasions with, they didn't do anything virtuous to deserve it. They hadn't made any points in the system, you know, so they got their gold star. But they came from really deprived backgrounds. I got to do something very small that was just for them. You know, didn't benefit anybody else. It was just for them. And something I knew. The satisfaction I received from that experience was momentary, okay? The satisfaction I still have from that experience is there, if not bigger. Now, it's a very mundane way of talking about pervasive suffering. So essentially what I'm saying is that most of the things that bring us happiness, it's like really temporary, and that, I'm embarrassed to say this, but there's a comic on YouTube called Louie. And I was being very unnunly one night, and I was looking at YouTube, and I was supposedly going to look at Venerable Rabina's teachings on YouTube, but my sister used to be a stand-up comic, so I'm kind of attached to that. And so, matter of fact, she still does stand-up comic for the Insight Meditation Center in Boston for their fundraisers. So now she's a Buddhist comic once a year. But the point about that was, so, and he uses, Louis uses some bad language and everything like that, but he did this one stint about why have a girlfriend? Because as soon as you have the girlfriend, you know she's going to break up with you. So having a girlfriend means suffering. You know, and then he did this thing about, why have a baby? You're going to have to pay their college bills. And they're going to leave you, and they're going to be adolescents, and they're going to wreck your car. And he, you know, and he just, but I mean, he went on. And I know that's, if my teacher was here, he wouldn't shoot me because he's very kind and he doesn't kill. But he would go, oh, Condola, you have to study more. But if you look at any experience you have, what the Buddha was basically saying is kind of built into it. into the fiber of it, is a lack of satisfaction. And it's just something, not something. Oh, I'm presenting it as a hypothesis. Examine it for yourself. See if it fits for any of your own experiences. And that's the best I can. Hi, can just hand it to me, Scott, and I'll go. Thank you.
So basically with pervasive suffering, it's kind of like the example of the cake thing, but the similar principle could use for like food. As soon as you eat, then that eases your suffering and hunger, but then after a while it goes away. Is that what you're trying to say with that? The pervasiveness?
Pervasiveness, that I guess we would say that even the fact that we have to eat, suffering is built into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to make sure.
Okay, good. Thank you. Sorry. So, and that's a very inadequate description. Go talk to Alex Berzin. He'll be really helpful. So, okay. So, this is the kind of suffering. So, that brings us to the 10 non-virtues. Okay? So, if you kill, you steal, sexual misconduct. What the definition of sexual misconduct in terms of this is, don't steal somebody that's not yours. Basically what it comes down to. And be honest and forthright. And do no harm. I mean, obviously, you know, rape is kind of sexual misconduct, but it is stealing something that's not yours. So there are three non-virtues of body. There's three non-virtues of mind. So it's lying, harsh speech, divisive speech, and idle gossip. And then covetousness, jealousy, harmful intent. Harmful intent, you know, intending to do harm. You know, even if you don't do it, you can spend a lot of time in your mind thinking about it. And wrong view, that gets into Buddhism in terms of whether you not believing in cause and effect and not believing and not seeing things as they actually are. But we won't kind of get into that. So eliminating that one, which would take days to explain, have any of these things ever brought anyone here, and this, you don't have to answer this question, it's a rhetorical question, have any of these things ever brought anybody here permanent happiness? You know, and so what the Buddha is saying is if you don't want to suffer, don't do this. And if everybody just did this, can you think of the number of people in the world that wouldn't be suffering? It'd be huge. I mean, we could stop right there and it'd be a great place. I mean, I'm not saying not stop there, but it'd be pretty good. Okay. So that gets us to the solution. So what's the solution? So, interestingly enough, the solution started when the Buddha stopped being mean to himself and stopped eating only one grain of rice a day. And he decided that, you know, if I'm going to really work on my mind and I'm still in this body, I kind of got to take care of it and stuff. So the solution starts by what he suggested were the six perfections. The first one is, generosity. What's generosity mean? We usually think generosity can happen in a whole bunch of forms. The first one is, the first kind of generosity is we give things. Second kind is we give protection. I mean, what's one of protection in terms of, you give protection when you stop at a stop sign. You protect your own aggregates. You protect everybody else's aggregates. I mean, just even obeying the law, whether you like the law or not, if they're traffic laws, it's a generous thing. You're being generous to yourself. You're being generous to others and stuff. So, and then the third thing from a Buddhist perspective is what they call giving the Dharma, which is if people ask and they want, they want to learn something about the path, you tell them about it. That's one thing. I'll go back to the history of Buddhism. The one thing the Buddha was very clear about is they didn't want any missionaries. He was very clear that you weren't supposed to go anywhere and say, I've got the answer, guys, and let me tell you about it. He said the anything he had to offer was not to be shared unless it was requested. You could help people, you know, you could do anything you want to help them. But in terms of the teachings, it was to be offered only when it was requested. So the second perfection is ethics, okay? And that's kind of don't steal, don't lie, you know, whatever your code of ethics are. Patience is it's a little bit different here. Now, there's the patience that we both know of let's see. You have to call Time Warner Cable. I don't mean to be unkind to them, but that's sometimes an opportunity for me to practice patience. I have to... one of my teachers talks about... practicing patience, and she says somebody was saying how they let somebody in the grocery store go in front of them, and she was venerable Shodron and said, that's really, really wonderful. How big was your cart? And they said, well, I had a really full cart. And she said, and how about the person you let go in front of them? And they said, well, they just had two items. And, which is still, it's wonderful. It is a practice of patience. And then Venerable Shodron said, she said, well, I have an opportunity for you. Do you want to keep growing in patience? And the person said, yes, Venerable Shodron, yes. And she said, the next time you only have two items and the person behind you has two carts and a baby, why don't you let them go in front of you? and so the reason I say tell that story is the other word for patience is forbearance. I mean, in this tradition. And what they mean by that is we all have difficult situations. And just kind of accepting them and living with them without kind of, you know, allowing your mind to kind of remain spacious in that situation is forbearance. Now, again, if all of us just did this, you know, we'd all feel like we're living in kind of paradise, to tell you the truth. I mean, couldn't, you know. And then the Buddha added, joyful effort. Be happy while you're doing all of this and never get tired of doing it. The Dalai Lama, one of the Dalai Lama, famous quotes from his Dalai Lama is just never give up. So joyful effort, the description of joyful effort is just never give up, never give up, never. It's okay to be tired. It's okay to just kind of relax. You know, I mean, it's all going to happen to us, but you just say, okay, I'm resting so I don't have to give up. That's the point. It's not about. So no throwing in the sponge. Concentration, that's what we're doing when we start to count our breaths and work on our minds. And a better word for, more and more I think about concentration, but I also think about it as focus. Becoming skillful about choosing what we're going to pay attention to. What are we going to pay attention to, and what kind of energy are we going to put into paying attention to it? That's what concentration is about. And then what comes with, when we can skillfully choose what we think about, then we have a chance of just, you know, developing some wisdom. Now, the ultimate in the sixth perfection of wisdom is this seeing, seeing things as they actually are without the stories attached or what we expect, what we don't want, all of those things. But at the very least, what begins to happen when we develop some focus is some discrimination about what is the most beneficial thing to do. And so Being a baby Buddhist, that's as far as I expect to get in this lifetime. I won't speak for anybody else here. So, it's 8:23. Any questions about all of that? Tim, I remembered. I called him David earlier. That's, you know.
Well, I can't help but wonder, one can practice these things himself or herself, but so what happens when you're around the water cooler and everybody is idly gossiping and doing all these things that you sort of, you can't exactly just walk away, and maybe you could still practice sort of the six perfections, as it were, but what's sort of the...
Okay, that's a great example. Can you give me an example of a remark? And this might be way too brave for you, but...
Well, I can at least certainly think of maybe not specific examples,
okay,
but
yeah,
certainly examples where people criticize other people's, you know, behaviors or actions, and they're not really wrong or anything. They're just sort of annoyed by what someone has done, and they're, you know, just saying, what is this person thinking? It's crazy. It's whatever. And it's really just...
You mean another coworker, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And they're,
okay,
you know, it's just about this, you know, their opinions on someone's actions, that it's really just a very subjective view. There's no sort of tolerance involved. There's no, you know, put yourself in that person's shoes kind of mentality.
They don't want to hear that.
They don't care about it.
Yeah, I understand.
And
that.
You're around
Getcha.
There
and
just
you
like,
go,
oh.
And you can't be rude. Oh, yeah, he's a, yeah. Even walking away. Well, and I guess the thing is at some point maybe you can be really brave, and that's what you do is walk away because, I'm going to back up. I'm going to answer it from two points of view. Can you be at the water fountain, listen to it, and not have it disturb your mind stream?
Not yet.
Okay. So the first point of practice would be take care of your own mind. And if that means... And this is very Tibetan, okay? This is what the Tibetans are really good at, never lying, but they're really good at not answering the question. Or answering a different question. Or shifting the time frame. Now, none of it is lying. And I don't even, and it's not even lying, it's not even kind of an intent to deceive. So I'll use an example. You're sitting, you know, in someone's, and you kind of feel your mind like, grinching up, you know? My favorite phrase was, excuse me, I'm expecting a phone call. Now, I didn't tell them that the phone call was tonight. So I didn't lie. I was expecting a phone call. Well, they wrote the rest of the story that it was in the next 10 minutes. You know? Now, and I'm not being rude, but I protected my own mind. I didn't lie, I didn't put them down, and I walked away. So my suggestion when they're doing that is for you to have a repertoire of things that are valid, you know, that allow you to walk away. Because it's really important to start taking care of your own mind. Because you taking care of, and I think the long view is, you taking care of your own mind will, in the long run, benefit them. The other thing a Tibetan would do is they would change the topic. Not, they would, you know, someone's talking and there's a space in and you would go, wasn't it beautiful coming in this morning? I'm so glad I'm going to get to go outdoors at lunch for a few minutes. My experience with that is it's amazing how sometimes the conversation shifted. You didn't agree with him, you didn't disagree with him, you didn't, you know, and you have to kind of work with the people you're working with. But the Tibetans are really skilled at changing the topic and stuff. So I don't know if any of that's beneficial to you, if that
no,
seems practical.
It does. It does a lot. I mean, when I feel my mind clenching up, when I start to really realize it, I'll just tell myself to breathe,
mm-hmm.
you know, let it not let it go, but just sort of pass and just, you know, don't get so caught up in it. But I do appreciate those thoughts on it, and I think I'm actually going to try to practice some of those this week. So
right, and then the other thing that I would do in my mind would be, there's, and I said it earlier today, it's from Sharon Salzberg. None of this is original. I steal everything. But the Buddha said I could, so what the heck. I give sources wherever I can. Sharon Salzberg, it's one of her most wonderful meta things. So she said, may you be safe, may you be healthy, may you be happy. And so one of the things I'll just kind of start saying in my mind is, first of all, and she always said, say it for yourselves first. May I be safe. May I, you know, and I can think it without saying it. And then I'll say it about the person. You know, and if nothing else, it protects my mind. And I have to say, I really am honest about being a baby Buddhist. Sometimes it's really all about my just protecting my mind. So I don't do something I'm going to regret.
I find during those moments when I am able to sort of let go of that anxiety and getting caught up and take a breath, that sort of relaxation can sometimes turn the whole tide as well. But once I'm in that moment and can't get out of it, I'm just as wrapped up with that angst and anxiety as they are.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can sort of switch out of it, that could switch the whole situation too. So.
Yeah, and the other thing is going, before you go to the fountain, again, intention, before you go to the water fountain, it's like you prepare to go to say, you know, okay, I'm going to take care of my mind here, knowing it will benefit others. And you wanted to, is that?
Well, yes, I actually was thinking about when I am tempted to be the harsh, do the harsh speech, and when things are, you know, when there's great agreement that this person is not doing things the way they should be done. And, or really when, what if it's in a case when someone is violating another in some way? And when they're, then the avoidance that you just described doesn't really seem appropriate. It seems like then a miscarriage of justice keeps on happening, or a violation keeps on happening unless I stand up and say something. So maybe I'm mixing.
Well, and I guess what he's saying, okay, so that's a really good question. So what he's saying is, we're talking about chattering around the water fountain, and if he enters that fray, the Dalai Lama has this thing, is if something wrong, something bad is happening, you know, and you clearly, you know, bad, whatever that means, is, if you can do something about it, do it. If you can't do something about it, you know, don't worry about it. But I guess what I'm saying is the chances of his having any positive impact around the water fountain is probably pretty zip.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about, I mean, I guess my example in being in the school system would be, you know, I know that, you know, a kid is being bullied on the playground, and even though I'm not the proctor, I'm not the playground person involved, I don't see what I could do to alleviate that situation.
But what if I do?
What?
What if I do see?
What if I did see it? And what I'm saying is, I do see it. I'm not the proctor in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I'm seeing a child. First of all, I don't know if the proctor saw it, the proctor didn't see it, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I might look at my situation and see, okay, what can I do to...
Using generosity and ethics and patience and joyful effort and concentration and wisdom, what can I do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would use it. So I don't know what situation, let's talk about bullying on the playground. I just see it at the moment. I don't know if it's a pattern, I don't know if it's a habit, but I see it. I'm on my way to do something else, so I'd really rather be doing it. But I can walk over to the group of kids and go, hey guys, what's happening? It breaks it up momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
So I have prevented it. I know I find out it's a pattern. I don't know the resources, and I can't use the, think of the resources in my school. One of the things that came up in my school was proctors weren't just live bodies on the playground. They were kind of supposed to be scanning and checking in. And so that was hard for proctors on the playground to do because they just came out of 5 hours of no break. They were brain dead. And they were going back into 3 more hours of working with kids in a classroom. And they were just So what did we do for proctoring on the playground so that there could be live minds watching the kids, you know? That kind of thing. So does that make sense in terms of, but that would be my responsibility, you know, and am I willing to take it on? Does, I don't know if that fits your situation or not. And then the other thing is, you know, at some point, are you brave enough? You know, and I'm not saying he should do it because the thing is, he has to look at the consequences of your her behavior. I mean, when I was 2 months out from retirement, when there was a lot of crap going around a conference room table and I didn't like what was being said, man, I was short. It didn't matter. I could speak up and say, I don't want to be part of this. 3 years before that, I wasn't about to do that because these are people I had to talk into doing things in the future. And I better be careful I didn't burn any bridges. 2 months out, it didn't matter if they didn't like me anymore. But 3 years earlier, if I was confronted with the fact that I had to convince that teacher to meet with me and a parent around an advocacy issue for a child, I didn't need that teacher thinking, I'm not meeting with someone with her. So, and I'm not saying I was right or wrong or I had great wisdom on it. I'm just saying. Does that make... It's hard. It's hard. You know? I can't think of the number of times I've either shot myself in the foot positively or shot myself in the foot negatively. I mean, I should be, you know, I should be kind of like walking on stubs because of the number of times I've done that. You know? I mean, and I'm not done yet, I'm sure. Any other questions? We need to kind of close, so... I really, really appreciate it when you bring up things. I really do, because I think they're very challenging. So let's just close with, we've spent some time together. I'm really grateful for your patience listening. You're very, very kind in your listening and in your attention. I hope that whatever thoughts you had during this, they're of benefit to you. I hope I set the aspiration that maybe something I said during this chatter up here may have been of benefit. And thank you for being here. And I'll see you maybe yes, maybe no. I'll see you next week. Thanks. Good night.
So two quick announcements.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Oh, yes.
Two quick announcements. Sherry in the bookstore asked me to let everybody know that the bookstore is not going to be open next week. If you are coming next week, if you wanted to get a book or anything, either this week or the week after. Also, just a reminder that we, you know, everything we do here is done free of charge. Most of the people who keep this center open and operating are volunteers. We only have a couple people who get paid to do anything here. But we still have some expenses. We have to keep the lights on and everything. So if you enjoyed this evening and you would like to make a contribution to the center, we have donation boxes right outside and by the front door. And any donations are very much welcome. So, and thanks to everybody for coming.
Yes, Duke Power, Progress Energy, has not agreed to donate our power bill yet.
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't worked on that. So, and we're not all so enlightened that we don't need electricity.